Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Jack Reiter. I'm here on behalf of Kinsale Insurance Company. May I proceed, Your Honors?
You may.
Thank you, Your Honors. As a threshold matter, our position today is that Kinsale is entitled to judgment as a matter of law when the court examines and applies what we believe to be a clear and unambiguous pollution exclusion that was set forth in an endorsement that explicitly states that it replaces and supersedes the prior earlier policy language. That endorsement provided that it precludes coverage for any loss, damage, expense, or increase in loss, damage, cost, or expense, which arises from any kind of seepage or any kind of pollution and or contamination or threat thereof. And the pollution exclusion further defines seepage of pollution and or contamination to include but not be limited to the seepage of or pollution and or contamination by anything including but not limited to any materials designated as a hazardous substance by the United States Environmental Protection Agency. Now, it is not disputed here, Your Honors, that the acetone and methanol, the chemicals that released vapors, that the vapors that seeped out and would ultimately ignite the flame that was on a table, those were in fact hazardous substances and therefore fall clearly within the definition of pollutants as used within the exclusionary language. And
Mr. Reiter, can I suggest, I think you're clearly right on the noun. I think this is clearly a pollutant. I don't understand how you can construe this contract for this not to be a pollutant. What I'm not sure you're right about is the verb. And you kind of are skipping over the verbs, but the verbs also strike me as important. Seepage, pollution,
yes, Your Honor.
Or what's the third one?
Well, I think the main verb is seeping, Your Honor, is what I think Your Honor is
referring
to.
Yeah, and I guess what I would say to you is when I hear the word seep, that does not to me convey what you're arguing here. When I hear the word seep, I'm thinking of a barrel that has a liquid in it, and the liquid is sort of leaking out of – I guess I'm thinking of seep as somewhat similar to leak. I just don't think as a matter of plain English usage what you're suggesting here falls within the at least the unambiguous meaning of the word seep. And would you like to help me with that?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And I think we can look together at the term any kind of seepage – as utilized in the policy language. And I'll just point out parenthetically that this exact pollution exclusion has been found to be unambiguous by at least three or four different courts that we've identified in the brief. But here's what the language of the exclusion says on the question of seepage. The term any kind of seepage or any kind of, pollution and or contamination as used in this endorsement includes but is not limited to seepage of or pollution and or contamination by anything, including but not limited to, let me see if I can find. I want to find for Your Honor the exact language.
Sir, I appreciate that. It's sort of circular because it says seepage is defined to include seepage. And then the other two verbs that were in the original definition, which I understand you probably didn't write this contract, doesn't strike me as a particularly useful definition to repeat the verbs being defined.
Well, I guess, Your Honor, I completely understand the court's point. But the term seep or seepage, I think if one were to look at the ordinary language, and quite honestly, I don't recall that either the district court even or the other side explicitly challenged the concept or the word seepage as being ambiguous. Now, I would.
But you'd agree that you all wrote this thing, right?
Well, yes, Your Honor. And as I indicated,
you all wrote it. That's right. But now I'm going to get back to something more basic. How do we get jurisdiction here?
Over this case, Your Honor, the district court certified it for immediate review under 54B.
Under Rule 54. Neither side briefed the jurisdictional point, but you say we got jurisdiction under 1292A1, I think, which governs injunctions. Is there any jurisdiction under that statute?
Your Honor, I believe
no injunction.
I believe that the jurisdiction of this court lies entirely under 54B as a matter certified by the district court as one that would assist in expeditiously evaluating issues pertinent to the overall.
It's an interlocutory appeal, correct? You say it's the final order appeal. Is it an interlocutory appeal?
Your Honor, I believe that 54B is construed as a final judgment for purposes of this court's jurisdiction.
But what's left on the table? What was left on the table?
What's left to be adjudicated, Your Honor, are breaches of contract and bad faith claims brought by...
What's the value of the claim here? What's the amount of money? He ordered you to pay the claim. What's the number that applies to that claim?
Well, Your Honor, the amount of the claim and the amount at issue still remains unresolved, and that is going to be heard...
That's a jury question to be resolved, correct?
Well, that's correct, Your Honor, but the issue of whether or not the policy...
So the value, the amount of the claim is yet to be resolved by jury, so it's no question this is an interlocutory order.
Yes, Your Honor.
Can I ask you, my understanding is that the district court certified a final judgment under Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 54B, is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And I guess my understanding has been that when the court does it, those claims that have been resolved are a final decision under 28 U.S.C. 1291, not 1292. Isn't that right?
That is also my understanding, Your Honor. And if we cited 1292 in our brief, which I don't believe we did, Your Honor, but if we did, that would have been a mistake and an error on our part. But I didn't think that we did, but if we did, I apologize. This is a 54B certified final judgment because the district judge concluded that it would facilitate that the disposition of this issue was a threshold issue that could expedite the conclusion of the entire matter. So I do believe the court does have jurisdiction, and I don't believe that's been...
The other side resisted that. You made the motion, and the judge granted the certification the next day without getting a response, and they came in and moved to vacate it and said it was not appropriate for an appeal, which they've apparently abandoned on appeal for some reason. But we have an obligation to satisfy ourselves, even though neither party has briefed it, we have an obligation to satisfy ourselves that we have jurisdiction. That's the reason I'm raising the question, that neither of you briefed it.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
They resisted it in the district court. Anyway.
Yes, Your Honor. The basis of it
is the 54B certification, I agree. Is it an appropriate 54B certification is what we have to decide.
Yes, Your Honor. And first, I will say that you are correct that it was resisted by a motion for reconsideration that the district judge spent approximately, I think, 6 weeks addressing or examining before he issued his ruling. And so he did take the time and gave the other side opportunity to address 54B. And again, you are correct that the other side has not advanced any challenge to this court's appropriate authority to review a 54B final judgment as certified by the district judge. And of course, if further briefing on this jurisdictional issue would be appropriate, we will, of course, provide it to the court to the extent it's requested. We will provide it. I, of course, want to get back to Judge Hayden's question about the issue of seepage, because I don't want to, if I may, Your Honor, Judge King.
Well, go ahead, unless you have something further to say on jurisdiction. I just was wanted to ask about jurisdiction because we have to decide that first. And all haven't briefed.
Understood, Your Honor. And our position here is that this is a final judgment.
The fact that you say there's jurisdiction and the district court says there's jurisdiction and the other side says there's jurisdiction doesn't give us jurisdiction.
Yes, Your Honor. You are correct, and I would submit that once 54B certification is provided by the district judge, that creates a final judgment under 1291, which vests this court with jurisdiction. And if we need to provide any sort of supplement, Your Honor,
we have to decide whether it's an appropriate 54B, which is interlocutory. It's an interlocutory order. There are issues remaining to be decided, including how much the claims worth. And this is an odd situation anyway, because you're the insurer. And they made a claim against you, and instead of denying the claim, you sued them. This is your insurer. It's the insurer suing the insured. Usually, they seem to come up in the other direction.
The insurer
is usually suing for coverage. You sued them to say there wasn't any coverage. without denying the claim. You've never denied the claim.
Your Honor, lawsuits for declaratory relief in terms of a question examining coverage, I would submit, are not completely out of the ordinary and can, in fact, be quite common in some jurisdictions. So I think here, when Kinsale filed their lawsuit, there were a few points that were raised. And specifically, our position is that the pollution exclusion does, in fact, bar coverage here. And the reason we believe it does, I want, again, going back to the issue of seeping, Your Honor, I would submit that the ordinary definition, the ordinary dictionary definition, or plain language of seep to flow out slowly, or to emit slowly, or to be something to be emitted, to seep here, Your Honor, I would submit is not ambiguous. And I would also respectfully suggest that when we look at the fact that here it is undisputed that there were vapors that were flowing, seeping, emanating from these canisters, and that those vapors were highly flammable and were in fact ignited, it is our position that at least at a minimum, we believe that as a matter of law, that should be deemed the efficient proximate cause of the loss here. And at a minimum, it's a question of fact. And we've cited multiple cases from various jurisdictions, including, of course, the Murray case, that talk about the fact that the efficient proximate cause doctrine presents a question for the trier of fact. Now here, I think it is critical that the undisputed expert testimony that was provided by Kinsale came from two different witnesses. One was George Harms from the West Virginia State Fire Marshal's Office, and then Allison Brenneman, an arson investigator that counsel the other side doesn't even address Ms. Brenneman's affidavit in their brief. And Ms. Brenneman testified, and this is in the record at Joint Appendix 2190 and 2191, that the tabletop fire, and we acknowledge that there was a tabletop fire. That was the first event that was a, quote, fire, unquote. But according to Ms. Brenneman, the tabletop fire ignited the flammable vapors and, quote, had the chemicals not been present and had only the plastic ignited, the fire would have been contained to its area of origin, assuming the proper use of fire extinguishers, unquote. That is undisputed expert testimony that I don't believe JDBC even addresses in their answer brief. And the bottom line is that at a minimum, the efficient proximate cause here, the qualitatively predominant cause of the loss, is a question of fact that should have been relegated to a jury, although we believe that based on...
Yeah, counsel, can we move to that? So far, you've been focusing on your swinging for the fences argument, which is that not only should the district court not have granted summary judgment against you, it should have granted summary judgment in favor of you. Can I ask you to take a minute and to make what you think is the best argument where, at minimum, the court should remand for something other than summary judgment in favor of one of the parties?
Absolutely. At a minimum, we are entitled to a trial on all of these issues. And here's why. At a minimum, Murray and other cases have consistently held that in overwhelming number of cases, what constitutes the efficient proximate cause of a loss is the question of fact for the jury. So at a minimum, it's not up to the district judge and perhaps not even up to this court. It's up to a trier of fact to listen to the evidence, to hear the expert testify, and to make a decision about was the predominant cause of the loss, not the first, not the last. When there's a concurrence or a conflagration of events that arise in the chain or link in the chain, a question for the jury is to decide which one of these events constitutes the predominant cause of the loss. That's a question for the trier of fact.
Is your view also that the estoppel issue would be at minimum a question for the trier of fact?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Absolutely. And I'm happy to go through every nuance of that if Your Honor would like me to turn away from the pollution issue. I see that I only have a few seconds left. If I may use some of my rebuttal time to address that question, Your Honors, if I may. Let's talk about the issues of the estoppel, because here I believe that is overwhelmingly a question of fact. What we know about this case on that issue is that, first of all, construing all inferences in favor of Kinsale Insurance Company, we have an initial application at JA 267 that says that sprinklers were, quote, being installed, unquote. At Joint Appendix 244, a supplemental application said that the fire suppression had been contracted to Brewer Sprinklers. Now, it would later be admitted that nothing had been done. None of the sprinklers had been installed. The plans for the sprinklers had not even been submitted at that time for approval by the state. And that's at Joint Appendix 636. Now, Emily Meyer, Kinsale underwriter, testified at Joint Appendix 1524 that, quote, at the time of binding, my assumption was that sprinklers were installed. And she explained that at the time the application was presented on September 6, 2019, she believed that the idea that the sprinklers were, quote, being installed, unquote, she interpreted to mean, as she testified, that she presumed that they were in the process of being done and believed that by the time the insurance was issued later on, a week later, she believed that the sprinkler system would have been concluded. And the timing here, Your Honors, the timing gives rise to, I believe, very significant questions of fact. And here's what I mean when I talk about timing. The JDBC had borrowed from the Small Business Administration, and under the facts of this record, they needed to close the loan by September 6th. And that means they needed to have insurance coverage in place by September 6th. Now, on August 31st, Brian Coakley, the chief executive officer of JDBC, advised Mr. Wilkins, the broker, that the loan was closing on September 6th and, quote, JDBC needed to have insurance in place before that, unquote. That's at Joint Appendix 1422 through 1424, which means that there was only 3 days to bind insurance because of the September 3rd, because there was a preceding holiday. So between September 3rd to September 6th, Mr. Wilkins had to procure insurance for JDBC in order that JDBC could acquire the loan from the Small Business Administration. So what I would suggest to the court is that they submitted the application, they said sprinklers were being installed, and then we have further indicia that there was an understanding by Kinsale that at the time both of the application being presented and at the time that the insurance policy was bound, that there were in fact protective safeguards in place. So for example, I would ask the court to look at our supplemental appendix 94 and 95, SSA 94 and 95. Why these documents are important, and this is all discussed in our briefs, is because these documents present contemporaneous, at the time, business records from Kinsale manifesting a belief that there were, in fact, sprinkler systems and theft protective measures in place at the time the insurance was bound. So, for example, at SSA 94, on September 6, 2019, the day the application was submitted, you will find that there's references there from Emily Meyer, who also testified in this case, that, quote, all safeguards are in place, unquote. At SSA 95, Emily Meyer wrote a note in the Kinsale, these are internal documents that say, all security measures are fully operational. And she describes the safeguards, and it says, sprinkler is being installed. If we look again at the internal notes, on October 23rd, 2019, there's a document, a notation from Will Farmer at Kinsale, who writes P1/P2 in place. P1 and P2 were the protective safeguards for fire. And it says security system being installed currently with remaining P9. That's the protective safeguard for the theft measures. So at a minimum, on estoppel, which is a fact issue, and examining all inferences in favor of Kinsale, which against whom the judge ruled on the summary judgment, I would respectfully submit that at a minimum, it is a question of fact for the jury as to whether or not estoppel applies when we have clear disputed issues as to whether or not Kinsale believed, based on internal documents created at that time and testimony, that there were in fact protective safeguards in place at the time they issued the insurance policy, particularly when we have all this documentation that says that the sprinklers are being installed, that theft measures have been already installed, when in fact we would later learn that none of that had been done, none of it. So that's why I think, Your Honor, at a minimum, we have significant questions of fact As I mentioned, I know I'm deep into my rebuttal time, so unless there are any questions about either the exclusion or the issues of fact, I would reserve on the remaining time. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. McMillan?
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Stuart McMillan, and I represent JDBC in this appeal. This was a fire loss, pure and simple. The undisputed record shows that. Kinsale has already conceded that in its briefing below with the district court. As the underwriter, Kinsale knew exactly what it was insuring. It issued a quote, it accepted applications, issued a quote, bound a policy, and conducted an inspection, took pictures, wrote a 7-page inspection report of the facility, and then accepted an $80,000 premium. That's undisputed. To fully understand this case, we have to put context to it. And that's one of the things that is glaringly missing from the appellant. This JDBC was to be one of the largest manufacturers of hemp-derived products. It uses a process, a closed-loop process, whereby solvents are used for the extraction process. Kinsale is a insurance company that specializes in offering coverage for this very industry. They understand the process. They understand the solvents that are used in this process. And Kinsale, in fact, has its own specialized and proprietary underwriting guidelines specific to this industry. In the summer of 2019, my client started a build out of preparing its facility to extract hemp. As part of that, it needed insurance. Correct. Kinsale needed business. Undisputed. In this, we filled out an application like all of us do at some level with respect to trying to secure insurance. In that application, and one of these is a Kinsale application and a basically standard Accord application, my client discloses that the fire suppression system is being installed. It also talks and discusses the manufacturing process, identifies the very solvents that are going to be used in this process as it is used throughout the industry. That application was provided to Kinsale. They had both applications. Kinsale then issues a quote. In that quote, there is a block whereby you can indicate your contingencies. In the quote provided by Kinsale, there's no contingency. Oh my gosh, you don't have your fire suppression system completed. Therefore, we're not going forward. That's fair. Underwriters do that all the time. They control the process at that time. But in this instance, there was no contingency except one of really relevance here, Your Honors. And that was we're going to conduct an inspection. Kind of what happened in the Colony case this court dealt with 3 or 4 years ago. The inspector goes to the facility and goes around the facility, takes pictures of the solvents, the barrels. It understands that the actual fire suppression system is being installed. It says it 3 separate times in its report, the same language that was in the application that was provided.
Let me give you a hypo that illustrates why my instinct is that this estoppel issue is a jury question. I agree with you on the I think we can agree on the following. This contract says you have to have a fire suppression system or they won't pay for fire damage. I think that is undisputed and true. I think it is also undisputed and true that the day they bound coverage, there was no fire suppression system and they knew it. But it's, and that they inspected later and there was no fire suppression system and they knew it. I think those things are all undisputed. But what I think is also undisputed is that your client repeatedly represented it was going to install one at some point. And so let me give you this hypothetical. I want you to imagine this fire happened 5 years after the inspection. And 5 years later, your client still had not installed a fire suppression system. Do you argue that they would be estopped then, that by binding coverage based on a promise you were going to do something soon, that they had for all time contracted to pay for fire damages, even if your client, in contrast to what it said, never installed a fire suppression system?
Your Honor, first of all, I think that these policies are renewed every year, so 5 years is a tough hypothetical. But the answer to this is how I'd answer this question. When we wrote being installed, that is actually very true. And let me say to your point, we had hired the sprinkler vendor months before the application. We had paid half of that contract, over $40,000. We had, Your Honor, a fire hydrant connected to and had municipal water run to the facility. We had pipes delivered. So I think, in fairness, to say that we kind of made a false promise, I don't think it's fair on the undisputed record. But if we went to your hypothetical and that we just weren't going to do anything at all with it, there would be more, I guess, favor of opinion that, hey, maybe this ought to go to a jury. But we don't have that, Your Honor.
Because but that's my question. To me, this case comes down to, what did the parties reasonably understand being installed to mean? And what is the scope of what a reason? Because I agree, they bound coverage knowing that you hadn't installed it yet. But it wasn't based on a we didn't and we're never. It was based on a we're going to do it soon or we're in the process of doing it. And once we're into estoppel like that, we're into the realm of equity and we're off to the races about what reasonable people understand things to mean and what a reasonable amount of time to do something is. And that seems really, really facty to me. It does not seem like summary judgment-y to me.
Your Honor, being installed means one thing. And that is, it is not installed. There's clearly disagreement that being installed does not mean installed. And as I was indicating, being installed is actually a very accurate portrayal. But Your Honor, the reason it doesn't go to a jury question is when your inspector comes there and as an underwriter, they have three options, Your Honor, that they can do when they go do their inspection, which is 11 days before the fire. They use the same terms we do, being installed. Everybody knows that it was not completed. And in that, they have three options.
But Mr. McMillan, I'm glad you point out that 11-day day. If you told me, if I come to your house and I say, you haven't done something you're supposed to do, and you say, I know, I'm so sorry, but it's being installed. Again, I'm not saying that I necessarily think they should get summary judgment, but if you told me something was being installed, I would expect that it would happen within the next 11 days. I don't think that I would understand being installed to mean 11 more days are going to pass and it's not happened yet.
Let me answer it this way, Your Honor. When we filled out the application, that was in early September. We utilized the term being installed. And as I indicated, the reason for that is we had a vendor that we had already paid and they'd already started. We had water and the hydrant already put to the facility. We had pipes that were there and brought in. The point I was making is they knew when they went to do the inspection in late October that it had not been installed. And my point is, Your Honor, under their own guidelines, and as an underwriter, they could simply do this. They had three options. Hey, you're not complying with what you put in your application. So therefore, we're going to return your premium. Number two, we're going to basically say, hey, there's non-compliance, give you an opportunity to quote, get it installed or fully completed. Or three, you make a deliberate decision to move forward and bind and uphold the coverage or provide the policy and provide the insurance. Your Honor, that's why this is not a summary judgment case on estoppel at this point. The case law is very clear. The actual control rests with the underwriter. It had the opportunity to say, we're not going to do this. Its eyes were on the field. It knew exactly what it was doing. So the idea that somehow, hey, you know, you put some assign some temporal aspect to it, that has no real meaning when you're actually there and you see it and you have three options under your own guidelines. And they chose.
And Mr. McMillan, I agree with you that that would absolutely be true if the fire happened on the day of the inspection. I absolutely agree with you that that would be true if the fire happened on the day of the inspection. I'd probably agree with you if it happened the day after the inspection. I guess it's just less obvious to me that you say they have these options. I mean, I don't think your client can go back to what their options under the contract were, because the moment we talk about estoppel, we're conceding that under the literal language of the contract, your client loses. And your client is the one making an appeal to equity for an equitable exception to what the contract otherwise would say that we do in this situation. And at that point, I think we're talking about what a reasonable person would understand and how a reasonable person would rely. And it's just not obvious to, and you know, there's also the principle that equity helps those who help themselves. And I just think there's an argument to be made, I guess I'll say, that equity does not protect a person who doesn't do something they're supposed to do, promises they're going to do it, then promises again they're going to do it, and 11 days later they still haven't done it, and then they get to the benefit of equity. Again, I'm not really suggesting that I think we enter summary judgment against your client on estoppel. I just think, to use the language I used with your friend on the other side, it is an awful big swing to me to say this is so overwhelming in your favor that you get summary judgment on it.
Your Honor, fair enough, but I understand your point. The reason that it is not subject to summary judgment from our client perspective is understanding the seminal law in West Virginia about estoppel in the context of an insurance company, and understanding the concept that an underwriter controls the risk. And if the underwriter knows about facts, in this instance, that the fire suppression was not completed, it has an obligation to make that known to us. One of the things missing in your scenario is that somehow they came back to us and said, hey, you haven't done this, you're making these promises. That's not a fair assessment of the record. In fact, we submitted an application and there was silence. We did not even know. We were working to obviously get things up and running. We wanted to go in a full manufacturing process. But Your Honor, the way the case law works in estoppel is clear fundamental law in West Virginia that if the underwriter knows about these facts but continues to go forward and issue a policy, then they are going to be bound by that to come back later and say, oh, wait a minute, this wasn't installed, therefore we were excluding it. That's why estoppel can be made as a matter of law here. Your Honor, what is your best case for that?
Mr. McMillan, I want to change gears. That's what I want to do. I don't know what, maybe Judge Hyden needs to finish, but I still don't understand the jurisdictional answer here. You all took the position there was no jurisdiction for this appeal with Judge Bailey, and then you didn't raise it when you come, didn't even brief it when it came down here.
Well, Your Honor, I'm going to give you a very practical and candid response, and that is
you wanted to get it over with.
That's we wanted to get this case moving as fast as we can. Our company,
You have an obligation to tell us that there is jurisdiction or there's not, and you conceded there was jurisdiction for some reason, or tried to, which you can't do, because we have to examine it ourselves.
Your Honor, you're correct that subject matter jurisdiction is something that the court must discern, and no matter what the parties say. But I was giving you the practical response is I got a company that has got sued and hasn't been paid for over 3 years and is essentially going underwater and becoming extinct. So that was part of it. But the second issue is this, and all I can say is it's under Rule 54B. You have to understand the actual complaint itself that was brought by Kinsale is a complaint for that there is no coverage. That was the extent of the complaint. And to that end, the court ruled that there was coverage and that you should have paid the claim and should have paid it 3 years.
But you didn't resolve the claim. You didn't resolve the claim. We don't know how much you're claiming. You don't have determination of the damages.
Well, we asked the court.
You have the Judge Bailey ruled there's coverage. All right. How much are they going to pay you if we uphold him? You don't know. You haven't had a trial yet.
Well, Your Honor, actually, we do know.
So it's interlocutory. It's interlocutory any way you look at it.
Well, Your Honor.
Resolution of the claim.
Your Honor, with respect to the value of the claim, it's $7.5 million. Our position is very clear that in their complaint, they never disputed the damages of the case. But I want to make that very clear.
They don't agree that that's $7.5 million.
Well, what they stipulate to after the fact
if you all can agree that it's $7.5 million, then that's what we got to resolve here, is whether they want to pay the $75 million. But Judge Bailey didn't rule that they didn't enter a ruling that they would want to pay you $7.5 million. He just said there was coverage. But for what? The value of the claim. He said that would be resolved later. We'll hold that off till later. That's what that makes it an interlocutory appeal. It's not a final order. Any way to look at it.
I understand, Your Honor. One of the points I'll make with respect to Judge Bailey, he ruled that the claim should be covered. It was, and actually in some of his orders on some discovery issues, that it was always a policy limits claim. What the point being is that they've never raised in their complaint, oh, by the way, there's no coverage and what you're seeking is only worth X dollars. My point of it is that's how the court got to where he got, is in other words, that the coverage and the limits should be paid. That has always been his position because they never, even though they sued us and didn't actually deny the claim, they never put in their lawsuit there was some issue as to the value, that it was somehow less than the policy limits.
So Mr. McMillan, can we assume that if you had sued them for failure to pay the claim, is it fair to say that you would have sought way, way, way more than $75,000 in damages?
Yes.
As in way, way, way over the amount in controversy. If you had commenced a lawsuit against them, the amount of money you would have requested would have been vastly above the amount in controversy requirement.
Yes, that is true. Your Honor, I'd like to, with all due respect, to talk a little bit about a couple of things. First of all, dealing with the efficient proximate cause, the most efficient proximate cause, Your Honor, I think that analysis is getting a little distorted. It's set out in West Virginia case law. It's also set out in Couch. What you're looking for in that case is the but-for. And this, again, is undisputed in the record. This was a heat gun set on a table, caused a fire. If that didn't happen, we would not have this loss. That's the but-for. That's why in the Matthews case, the court was able to, and that's the Supreme Court out of West Virginia, was able to affirm a summary judgment. You can look at that and determine that the efficient proximate cause is undisputed, and that is in the record. In all due respect, the comment made by counsel by some sort of expert that somehow blew that theory out of the water is absolutely untrue. This expert that was identified in a declaration in a reply brief, which we would argue is not a part of the act should be waived in and of itself, but in that representation by that expert, she's not disagreeing with the fire marshal and how the fire started. What she is trying to hypothesize and speculate that it got out of control because of, you know, the vapors and that caused this fire to be a lot worse. That's not the issue germane to the analysis of efficient proximate cause. And I would ask this court to realize that this has been set forth in the Matthews case and can be done. I also, Your Honor, with all due respect with this seepage, this is not a seepage case. Judge, you're square on. We know what seepage is. These barrels, many of which they took pictures of during their inspection, were sealed containers. This isn't something where it's leaking out and encroaching on groundwater and causing some sort of problem. This is nothing with seepage. And Your Honor, this is a first party fire case. And the cases that have been cited here, I'm sorry.
What about the report that talk about the vapors accelerated the fire or made it difficult to put out, and therefore it is the proximate cause of the extent of the damage? It may not be an issue about what ignited, but there isn't there a factual question as to what accelerated the damages? And she said vapors,
Your Honor, she just, the point of that is not really, that is not what efficient proximate cause is. It would make a pollution case and fire case is very difficult to discern. The efficient proximate cause analysis is used as a tool in a first party fire case.
No, it wouldn't. For example, if you were prohibited under the contract to have some pollutant on store on premises and a fire started and it found that, yes, the fire is normal negligence and would ordinarily be covered, but it's evidence that when the fire spread, it went to the area, to the pollutants that weren't supposed to be there, and it caused problems and it caused an explosion. You are saying that just because it's undisputed that it's a covered act that caused the ignition, then we don't have to worry about proximate cause as to the extent of the damages?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And I say this with this notion that there, when you look at the case law that defines sufficient proximate cause, there may be occasions where there are other perils that could be excluded. But if the but-for peril, which set everything in motion, is unbroken, and that leads to other losses, West Virginia law, a settled West Virginia law, provides that coverage should be afforded. And let me say this, Your Honor, with respect, and I'm going beyond my time, that's all right. But with respect to a first-party fire case, there are no cases that have been cited that exclude coverage like we have here. None of those do. In fact, some of the cases that are cited, they're talking about either pollution cleanup, which is not what we're talking about, or they're talking about third-party liability claims, which we're not talking about. In other words, we're not talking about the fire happens, Your Honor. It infects the integrity of one of the barrels. Later on, there's seepage of that barrel, and this liquids get into the ground, and they migrate over to someone in Maryland, and the person is upset with their well water or something like that, and they bring a claim. They bring a pollution claim. There are specific rules that apply to pollution cases, but this is a first-party fire case. And that's how the efficient proximate cause works. In the Matthews case, Your Honor, that case, the actual damages that were caused in that case was the demolition team. They actually leveled the dwelling. But our Supreme Court said the efficient proximate cause was actually the imposter that didn't cause any tangible damage. But the court said that was the cause that set it all in motion. And that's what is meant by the most efficient proximate cause. And that's how this court, and that's how the district court was able to discern and say, this is a fire case for which you had agreed to provide coverage for a fire, which is the number one peril of this manufacturer and of this industry. And you knew about these solvents, by the way, that they were going to use in this process. And you bound the policy and tipped the $80,000 premium. If you put this case in context, Your Honor, this court, you should affirm the district court. He did get it right and find that there is coverage, that is, as a matter of law, there should be coverage, and that the pollution exclusion does not apply in this instance. And therefore, we are entitled to move forward with the second part of the case. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you so much. Counsel, you have some time reserved.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me first emphasize why the estoppel issue is indeed a question of fact. From Joint Appendix 1534, Emily Meyer is explaining her understanding, and she says, from my understanding of the application, sprinkler systems were being installed. They were close. Sounds like they were close to being done. When I quote something, I'm sending out a document saying these are the terms and conditions that you have to agree to. The quote I indicated that sprinklers were in place. The broker, agent, and insured have to review that and then bind to that coverage. And there is a lot of testimony, that's just one highlight, where Kinsale expressed their understanding that, as pointed out, the concept of being installed is not some indefinite outlier of that could go on indefinitely. At the end of the day, it's a question of fact. And I think what we have to look back to is how, at the time of the fire, which wasn't until weeks and weeks later, Robert Coakley admitted at Joint Appendix 564, we can agree that you did not have an operating sprinkler system prior to using acetone and methanol for testing purposes. Answer, yes. And at page 636 of the Joint Appendix, and the drawings had not been approved by the state. Correct? Answer, correct. So this isn't even a case where the sprinkler system was about to be done and there was just one final hose that had to be connected. The plans for the sprinkler had not even been submitted for approval until after the fire. That absolutely creates a question of fact. So in terms of what the parties understood, it is a matter for a jury to evaluate. And I will go back just momentarily to this issue of seeping, Your Honor, because I did look it up. And seeping is to leak slowly. And here, I think it's very clear that the vapors did, in fact, leak slowly out of these canisters. And Judge Gregory, as you discussed with my opposing counsel, there is evidence in this record to demonstrate that it was the vapors that ignited, and that is what perpetuated the fire that resulted in the loss. And so ultimately, if we look at Murray, the question of what is the efficient proximate cause, what is the predominating cause of the loss, it ultimately goes back to a question for the jury to evaluate. Now, counsel said some disparaging, said some things that weren't about Allison Brenneman, and criticized our expert, but I don't believe that there's any reference in the answer brief challenging Ms. Brenneman's declaration, and Ms. Brenneman's declaration in the record averred that but for the vapors, this fire would have been contained to the table where it started. So if this is a matter of what is a predominant cause, is it the small fire that could have been contained on the table, or was it the vapors that caused the fire to extend throughout this facility and could not be extinguished? At a minimum, I would respectfully submit is a question for the jury. We did cite multiple cases, multiple, where pollution exclusions have been applied in similar circumstances. We cited Hilland Partners versus National Union out of the Eighth Circuit, where a flammable and explosive hydrocarbon condensate overflowed, caused an explosion. And because that is a flammable, volatile, and explosive chemical, the pollution exclusion applied to preclude coverage. Similarly, in Noble Energy versus Bituminous Casualty Company, the Fifth Circuit applied a pollution exclusion to preclude coverage when combustible vapors in a diesel engine exploded and said, quote, it indisputably met the policy's definition of pollutant, and the explosion indisputably arose out of the discharge, dispersal, release, or escape of such vapors, unquote. So we have authority that explicitly addresses this very issue, Your Honors. I appreciate the extra time that the court has provided. And finally, Judge King, I don't want to leave your question unanswered. I would ask the court go back, if it may, and review the district judge's detailed explanation as to why he believed 54B certification was appropriate. He explained it in very clear detail, and I would ask that the court maintain jurisdiction over this case and reverse and remand for a trial on the merits of these issues. Thank you again for your time.
Thank you, counsel, and thank you both for your arguments. We can't come down and greet you as we would like to, but know very much that we appreciate you being here and helping us with the case, and wish you well and be safe. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Your Honor. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Thank you. I'll ask the deputy clerk to adjourn the court for the morning session.
This honorable court stands adjourned until this afternoon. God save the United States and this honorable court.